Good morning. And good morning with my mic unmuted. Okay. So last time we talked about multi-level page table lookup. So we mentioned that we would, rather than taking our virtual page number as a whole thing, we take our virtual address, we divide it up into a virtual page number and a page offset, but we further divide up that page number into parts. So we'd end up with a PN, page offset, and a VPN. We would divide into these pieces for how many levels there were, and we'd use each piece, starting with the most significant one, to do our page table lookup at each level, and we had this sequence of page tables that would form this kind of tree structure. Where the page table at level n would point to the page table at level n plus 1, or if we ran out of levels, it would actually point to where the program's data or code was. Some questions about the level page table lookup from last time? Okay. So there's one topic I'd like to cover before we get to exam review briefly, which is about the TLB, which I alluded to, which is the cache for page table entry. So even if we do our page table lookup by sort of accessing the cache, it turns out that, especially with a multi-level lookup, this is much too slow for us to be doing on every single instruction. And I mean every single instruction, because we have to fetch the instructions from a virtual address. And so what we'll have instead is we'll have a small cache, a very, very small cache called a TLB. This is maybe not the best name for it, but it's what they came up with in the 60s, in the, or 70s, around there. And rather than, you know, it will look like the L1 cache as far as sort of the high-level organization, but it's going to have some key differences, and I've kind of summarized them here. So the L1 cache, we give it a physical address, we get some valid data from that address. Here we give it a virtual page number, the whole thing, and we get a page table entry that would be from the last level. So it's going to replace, when there's a cache hit, that replaces the whole page table access, the whole multi-level lookup is done by the cache. And to make this fast, the reason why this is going to be so much better than using our normal caches is where our normal L1 caches will end up with like thousands of blocks. Here we'll have like tens. And we can make that small structure way, way faster. So the performance impact of this is not so bad. And you might say, why can we get away with tens? Well, it turns out that because pages are many kilobytes, typically, our program doesn't have that many pages it wants to access in a short span of time. So only caching tens of things is going to actually be plenty. Whereas with the L1 cache, that probably wouldn't be the case. We have an array with 1,000 things. We don't want to just cache 10 of them. So questions about the TLB? Yeah?
When you say the last level, that means like if we have a three-level page table, that it would be getting the third page table entry?
So question, if we had a three-level page table, it would be getting the third page table entry? Yes. And I have a picture for this that kind of shows what it looks like, is that when we have a TLB hit, we will replace, I have this single level, but we'll replace the entire lookup. And with a multi-level, this would have another set of stages here. And we're just replacing the entire lookup. So with a multi-level, we'd have another part of the virtual page number and all that, but this would still replace the entire thing. You'd still get this entire virtual page number, use that to get what would happen at the end of the lookup. We want to skip the whole lookup. Okay. I do have that diagram. Okay, this is the picture I meant to show. So we replace the whole multi-level lookup. I do have a slide prepared for showing that whole multi-level lookup. So normally we do all this stuff that's kind of grayed out here, and it's going to replace them. Because we'll have cached it from an earlier time where we did the whole process. Okay, some questions about TLBs. Okay, so let's get to the main topic for today, which is, where did I put the window? Oh, I see. Hopefully that, okay, so let's get to the main topic for today, which is going to be our exam review. So as I said last time, I'm going to take your question. So tell me what you want me to talk about. I'm going to write all of those topics down, try to organize them, and then we'll go through them. If there's time at the end, I'll take another round of things you want me to talk about. Yes. Alisa, okay. System calls, okay. Anything else? And you can give me general topics. The more specific you are, the more less likely I am to talk about the part you care about. The more specific you are, the more likely I am to talk about the part of it you care about and not the part of it you already know.
Can we ask exam questions?
Yes, you should tell me what they're about, and I will need to.
Spring 2018 exam one, question eight.
2018. Which is about?
Move Q, LEA Q, load effective.
Okay, LEA. Okay. Yeah. So YAD6 machine code, what about the reading the diagram or what YAD6 machine code? Okay, machine code fields. Okay. Yeah.
Can you just go over pipelining?
Can we be more specific? I can go over pipelining generally, but I have a feeling I might just go over the things you already know. That's why I'm asking. Like hazard handling, or so? Like, do you want me? Do you want general pipelining, hazard handling?
We do hazard handling.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Invalid path.
Okay. Branch misprediction. Branch prediction, just like.
The invalid paths.
Like getting rid of.
From like I think it's ALU to memory.
Oh, this is not branch. So you're talking about forwarding and. Yeah, what forwarding is possible? Okay. Okay. Yes.
Can you go over? This was a quiz question from fall 2022. It's week 3, question 1, and it's about.
Quiz 3, question 1?
Yes, quiz week 3, question 1.
Oh, yeah. Week 3, okay.
And it's about like bitwise operations.
Bitwise, okay. Yeah. A, which is about data cache misses. Okay. Anything else?
Can you go over this dirty bit, the concept of it?
Okay. Dirty bits. Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over the fall 2022 week 2 quiz question 1-5, which is about relocation tables?
Okay. Okay, so let's sort these. We'll put this here, these go together, this goes here, these go together. Oh, interesting. I should probably prevent that from recurring. Yeah. The first one is 2018. What?
2018 exam one, not
2021 exam one. 2018 exam one, okay. Okay, so I have these in an order, so let me actually pull up. And any more before we all set for our first round of stuff. Okay, so let me pull up the old exams. Okay, let me get internet access so I can pull up. I see, I pressed the disable Wi-Fi button apparently. That helps. And now do we have Wi-Fi? They didn't schedule the maintenance for now, right? Yes, okay. Now I have Wi-Fi. Okay, so 2018 exam one, question 8. And on this question, okay, so this question is asking, we're doing here. So the question is asking, we have a long star star x, right? Yeah. And we're doing x plus equals star star x, where x is stored in R8. So we want to figure out what how this converts to assembly. And we're given actually several assembly options in the question. But I guess to sort of think about this, first I'll go over what should this do mechanically as far as our sort of accesses to memory and so on. And we're going to want to get star x. So x is going to be R8. So to get star x, we want to access memory at R8. And to get star star x, we want to that. So a way I could write this is I could say, move R8 into, move what R8 points to into some temporary. So in this case, RAX equals star x. And then move what that points to into some temporary. Now RAX, I'll probably make this RBX, so it's distinct. RBX equals star star x. And that gets me the thing we're adding to the pointer x. And the way adding to a pointer works is that this is, add 8 times star star x to the address in x. And why 8? Because that's the size of a loop. And that's because we're advancing an array of, the size of a long star. Because we're pretending we're advancing in an array of long stars that this points to. So it points to a long star, so we're saying it points to the first thing in an array. Let's assume that and advance that many elements, where the number of elements is star star x. So in my version of the assembly here, I have, this is the point array elements that are pointers to advance R8 by. So I want to advance R8 by 8 times that value. And one way I could do this is I could multiply this by 8 explicitly and then add that. I can also do that with LEA. So I can do an LEA of RBX 8 and R8 into R8. And this is going to be R8 equals R8 plus RBX times 8. So that's sort of my straightforward translation. Then we can look at the options. And it turns out I wrote basically what option A is. And then we have some wrong options we can look at. So this is basically what option A is. Some wrong options. So you can say, So for example, option B does starts with LEAQ RA8 to RAX. So this is computing RAX equals X times 8. And this value doesn't make sense for this operation. Okay. If you look at what we're supposed to do, at no point do we actually want X times, we don't want the address times 8. We want something it points to times 8. But this is like using the wrong thing to multiply by 8. So that's not a useful operation. And we see that that's carried through, so that's not going to work. Doesn't make sense. Multiplying the wrong thing by 8, then carried through. So, no. So option C, we have the same dereferencing. So we do these steps, where this goes into RAX. So this is great. Hey, star star X extracted. So that's good. But then we do RAX times 8 into R8. And this is setting X equals star star X times 8. You know, cast to a pointer. Like, we don't have the, so this is no, got no plus equals there. So that's a problem. And option D, we have this same first line, so we get star X, and then we do an LEA with that. So we do LEA R8, RAX 8, and this is going to set into a temporary. X. So this is going to set a temporary gets X plus star X times 8, which is not the calculation we wanted to do. We're multiplying the wrong thing by 8 again. So 8. So that seems like it's going to be suspicious. And if we work through, we'll find out we're not computing the right value in R8 again. Yes. Question, why am I adding 8 times this? So if I had a int star x that points to an array, I want x plus equals 2 to advance 2 elements in array. So we're pretending in this case, so the reason why we're multiplying by 8 in this case is that with a long star star x, we're saying I have an array of long stars that I want to advance in. That's what the C means here. Okay, so questions here, yeah.
So if you had long star x, like just a single star, then would you be advancing by 4 times star x because a long is 4?
So the question, if I had long star, I'd be advancing by 4 times because a long is 4. I'd be advancing by 8 still, but that would be because a long is 8, not because a long star is 8.
Okay.
On our systems, I should say. There's some systems where longs are 4, but not the ones we've been using in this class. Okay, other questions? Okay, and I'll skip option D because I think that's not the part people are confused by. But basically, you go through the assembly and you compute, what are we computing? Is it actually the same as this value we're supposed to compute? Yeah. And I sort of went through writing the actual assembly, but you could just do this by saying, here's the value I'm supposed to compute. Let's work through each of the assembly and see what they actually put in R8, which is X. Yeah. So question, the long star star x, that's just an array of pointers. This is a, the way I would call this type is this is a pointer to long. And hypothetically, that could point to the first pointer in an array of pointers. It could point to a lone long. If we're doing this operation, hopefully it points to some sort of array, because otherwise it doesn't make sense to do that. But it's still kind of well-defined what the how it should translate, even if it didn't point to an array of longs.
Okay.
question. You don't understand how. So why? So you don't understand why I'm adding the 8 times here?
Yeah.
So the 8 times here is because let's go to the simple case here. So if I have a pointer, I'll change the name of this pointer so we're not confused, hopefully. So I have this pointer y here that points to an array, and let's say the array is array of 4 ints, then this will give me a pointer, this y will point to array of 0, and we want to end up with it pointing to array of 2. If we do the plus equals 2, in order for that to happen, well, the array elements are size of int bytes apart, so I need to multiply by size of int. And the same principle is applying here, where we're kind of assuming that for the purpose of this pointer arithmetic operation, that it points to an array of something, so we're going to advance by the size of those array elements. Other questions? And I guess the other thing I didn't emphasize that came up here is that this LEA operations here, they're not accessing memory, right? We don't have, I'm not marking X as being dereferenced an additional time by doing these LEAs. Because it just does arithmetic. Okay, so then we got, anything on this question here? Yes.
When X is stored in R8, I guess I'm having a little confusion about how you're able to read the pointer to X by just putting it in parentheses. Wouldn't it just take the output of R8 and read that pointer from now on?
So the question, if when I do this, doesn't that mean R8 is now a pointer from now on? No. It's only this instruction that's going to take the value of R8 and use it as a pointer. So I could have, I could right after this, I can still use R8 as not a pointer, I'll put it. And that next instruction, that's not going to use R8 as a pointer because I didn't put parentheses indicating I'm trying to access memory. So I'm not dereferencing R8, right? We can kind of think of the parentheses in assembly as equivalent to dereferencing. But they don't indicate that we're changing what R8 is, how we use R8 forever. Just each instruction we look at individually, and that's how we decide what are we doing with the value in R8.
So it's more like casting R8 to a pointer, right?
The question is more like casting R8 to a pointer? That's I wouldn't say that because we can use pointers without dereferencing them. And this operation is really saying that I want to use the value in R8 as a place to access memory. If I think of the an add operation actually makes sense on a pointer, right? So even though, if I write add 8 to R8, this is an operation which makes sense with a pointer. It tells something I could do, and I'm not claiming by writing that instruction that R8's actually an integer. Because the processor doesn't distinguish, it just says they're numbers. The processor doesn't have a notion that a register stores a pointer or an address, a pointer or a normal number, quote unquote. All it knows is that they're 64-bit numbers, and that's it. And it decides how to use them based on what instructions you give. So each instruction tells it individually, do you use this to access memory or not? This is not like C, where our values have a type. We don't have types here. The values are always capable of being immediately used to access memory. There's no casting or anything like that going on. So obviously if we use a value that isn't a valid pointer, we'll get an exception to happen and our program won't work very well, but we can still do that, right? There's no barrier in assembly to doing that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So just the same thing. So in this case, we're using R8 as a pointer to long, and we're dereferencing it.
So in this case, we're implementing the operation of dereferencing R8 as a, in fact, dereferencing R8 twice. Yes, because it's a pointer to long. Yep. And I implement that by using these move instructions that access the memory pointed to by something. other questions? Okay, so let's go to, I should separate these, the fall 2022 quizzes, right. Quiz two, right, I have it right up in front of me. Quiz two, first for week two, question four or five, okay. Okay, so as a summary here, we have, I'll do it this way since I have the luxury. We have a void upper string, char star string that does some stuff that is not actually relevant here in sort of upper string.c. And we have a print big.c, which has a print big that has a char star string and calls upper string on it and calls puts on it. So if we think of what we need in the object files for these, so in the object files, we need sort of a way to find upper string in upper string.o and a way to find print big in printbig.o. And these are going to be symbol table entries, because those are what represents sort of places in the machine code or data for these files. And we also need a way to find where to put the address of upper string, that's upper string in print big's machine code, address of, and the same thing for puts. And these are relocation table entries. So the relocations are, we have holes in our machine code we're going to need to correct. I know because I have no idea from reading the code for printbig.c alone, which is what our compiler is going to do, where upper string or puts are going to be, I'm going to need a relocation to look for them. And I need the symbol table entries because I know somewhere else someone's going to need to find print big and someone's going to find upper string, or else these C files are pretty useless. Yeah?
So will there be a symbol table entry for everything that's defined in, upper string.c?
So the question is there a symbol table for anything that's defined in the file? And it's anything that's accessible from another file. So for example, if I had a static in foo, static global scope variables are not accessible from other files, so there wouldn't need to be a symbol table entry for that. But if there's something that could be accessed from another file, even if it's not declared in the header file, but if you could like access it by like declaring it as extern from another file, then yeah, there has to be a symbol table entry for it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. Hopefully. Okay, so then we have quiz for week three on Bitwise. Question one. Okay. So that's asking about this expression, and it's saying that the question claims that this is the same as, this is the same as x at y, equals x, y, the quantity equals 0 for some y, and ask you to find y. So let's go through what this expression does, and I'm going to kind of represent x as I'm going to say that it looks like from the operators here that only probably the 16 bits of x really matter, because if we look at every time we're using x, we're ending it with a value which only has up to the 16th bit set. So it looks like all the other bits are going to be irrelevant. So I'm going to get my 16 bits of placeholders. So I have A, B, C, D, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, P. This is my placeholder X, where this is just represents individual, each letter represents individual bits. And so I'm going to look at first what happens on the left-hand side. So we do at with FF0F, and F is, if we expand it to binary, is 41, 0 if we expand it to binary is 4 zeros. And ending with 1 keeps a bit, ending with 0 sets a bit to 0. So that ending on the left-hand side is going to give me ABCD, EFGH, a bunch of zeros, MNOP. And then we're going to shift over by 2 to the right. So that's going to give me, I'm going to just move everything over by 2 and have zeros at the top. I know there's zeros at the top because of what I just ended with. So even if there wasn't a zero there before, after ending, there will be. EF, GH, 0, 0, 0, 0, MN. So that's there. And then I'm going to AND that with FF0. So that's going to, we're going to do the same expansion. Jesus, give me that value. So that's the left-hand side. And then I have the right-hand side. I'm going to AND with FF0, so that's going to give me 0 EFGH KL 0 0 0. I'm going to shift over 2 EFGH. And then AND with FF0F 0 0 0 EF. And a bunch of zeros, and then KL00. So for these two things to be equal, we're going to take our final results and kind of line them up. So versus here. And we can see that we need to have CD, GH, and KL all be zeros for these two values to be equal, because we're just comparing bit by bit. And those are the bits that, if we look at the right-hand side, they're set right-hand side versus the left-hand side, we have 0 equals C, 0 equals D, and so on. So I know those bits need to be 0, and a way I can test if those bits of 0, is to test if CD, GH, KL are 0, we can use X and 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0 equals 0, because that just extracts those bits and compares them all to 0. And that gives us our value of y. So this here is y. Yes. And I'll use parentheses because I always forget precedence for these. So, okay. So questions? I figured that out. So this is sort of the general strategy I use to like work through these sorts of problems, is like just figure out what's happening to each bit, because usually different things are happening to different bits. Over there. Okay. Question back there?
Yeah.
Why is it 0011?
The very first binary set.
So the question is, how did I get the mask here?
Yeah, why is it 0011?
So I'm just lining up. I figured out here that CD, GH, and KL. And I just looked at my original X, which is ABCD, EFGH, HIJ, KL, MNOP, and figured out where CD, GH, and KL were and put ones there to extract those bits. And have all the other bits be set to zero before I compare it with zero. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
okay. Other questions? Okay. So. So then asking, then we have, why 86 machine code fields? Yeah, sorry.
I'm so sorry. Why is it CDGH and KL, not CDGH and EF?
Why is it CDGH and KL, isn't EF included?
Yeah.
So when we looked at the left right-hand side versus the left-hand side, we have EF being compared to EF. So if E is 1, it's going to be 1 on both sides, so that comparison is going to be true, so they don't need to be 0. But we had a problem with D, for example. If we look at D here, this bit D here is being compared with this 0, so it has to be 0. So let's go on to machine code fields. So we had our sort of the general layout. So I guess I will say on the exam, we will give you the chart of Y86 machine code if it's relevant. We're not going to expect you to memorize any of that, because that would be silly. You don't need to memorize which byte is RB in. No, we're not going to do that. But generally, kind of the general format is we have a sort of, in the first byte, sort of the upper bits are the primary opcode. So this is the row of the table. And the lower bits are, if needed, a secondary opcode. And this was because for very similar instructions, like, you know, variants of JX jump or J, you know, et cetera, or C move, or R move, C move, LE, et cetera, or you know, arithmetic instructions with different types of arithmetic. Right, so we have those secondary opcodes, so we could have like one shared encoding for them. So then in our second byte, so if relevant instruction, we'll have sort of register indices. So you know, we have up to 2 registers, so up to 2 register numbers, register indices that are from the assembly for the instruction. We had a table sort of mapping register names to indices. And this is if relevant to the instruction, because some instructions, like say JLE, don't have a register index, so we just omit this byte. The choice they've made. And then, you know, later bytes, we might have, and this is again, if relevant to the instruction, so some instructions don't need it, will be an 8-byte constant. And this constant can be various things, which has different names. So the 8-byte constant could be the target address of a jump or call, sort of where to go to. It could be the displacement for a move, for a RM move or MR move could be the immediate value for an IR move, sort of what to put in the register, and feel like I'm forgetting one, but can't think of it, so maybe not. But we just have various instructions. You have a constant in the instruction, and then we just put that afterwards. And exactly where this constant is, this starts at the third byte, if register numbers, and the second byte otherwise. So we had slightly variable placement, just because we decided not to store register numbers if the instructions didn't need any. Yes? The question is, what's the format of this constant? So the constant is a constant stored in the little endian, meaning that the lowest byte with the lowest address, is the least significant part. So for example, jump to 123 is going to be encoded as 7023 0100. I think that's the right number. Yeah. So 70, where we have our primary opcode, then our secondary opcode. And then this eight-byte constant written from lowest address, written with lowest address on the left. Left as sequence of bytes. So just written as a sequence of bytes. If I was writing it out as like I did in assembly, I don't write it that way. But as a sequence of bytes, the lowest address byte is 23, and I've just written it out. And hopefully I've remembered the opcode for jump. If I didn't, that's wrong. Other questions on machine code format stuff? Okay, so pipelining, sort of hazard handling generally, and what forwarding is possible. So pipelining, so talk about sort of briefly hazards. So we had data hazards, which were, so hazards generally are, we make our pipeline and find out it doesn't run instructions correctly because it doesn't handle dependencies yet. To handle dependencies sort of automatically. So we discovered this, and this happened, because when we were running parts of instructions in different orders. So for example, we might write a register after it would be read in the pipeline normally. So that was called, and this was called a data hazard. Or we might compute the address of the next instruction after we need to fetch it, which was a control hazard. And this reorganization happened because our pipeline divided things into stages, and normally we expect different parts of different instructions to run at the same time, and it turned out that those parts kind of had this problem where we had this dependency that didn't make sense, where we were doing things in the wrong time order, and we obviously need to fix that, or else we're going to get the wrong answer from our instructions. And sort of the strategies we learned, there might be other strategies that we could use to handle hazards. So one strategy we learned was stalling, that, get the operations back in order by inserting no operations between them. So because we had this problem that with the pipelining, we were doing something before something else when we shouldn't have been, we can fix that by just delaying one of the operations by inserting no operations. Sort of delay the thing that pipelining made happen too early relative to the other, relative to other instruction. So, for example, e.g., wait to read register until after it's written, or wait to go run instruction after conditional jump till after the jump is computed. So another strategy we learned was forwarding, and this was that this was for data hazards only. Get the value after it's computed, but before it's stored. So this, this solves a majority of data hazards, but requires that the value be computed before we need it in the later instruction, which won't always be true. And we mentioned we could combine that with stalling, and this can combine with stalling. So instead of stalling to wait for a register to be written, stall to wait for a value to be computed so we can forward. Wait, I am spelling great. Wait for a value to be computed so we can forward it. And most commonly sort of replaced a wrong value we just read from register file, but we could do this in other cases. We could do forwarding at other times too. But the most common pattern you saw is we'd read a wrong value and we replace that right away by getting the correct value from elsewhere in the processor. And then as for what forwarding is possible, so that's the rules we're going to look for, there's like two concerns. So one thing is that we need to have the value computed already, and we don't want forwarding to, adding the forwarding to extend our critical path much. So typically, we forward from, from the quote unquote end of a cycle to the end of a cycle, or from the beginning of a cycle to the beginning of a cycle. Because this won't add much to what needs to happen in a cycle. So let's say we try to forward from the end of execute stage to the beginning or the end of memory. Beginning of execute. Then this would not work well, because now our cycle needs to do beginning of memory, middle of memory, beginning of execute, middle of execute, end of execute kind of thing. Right. And we've now, you know, so this is going to be a much longer cycle time needed to accommodate this. You know, not kind of defeats having separate pipeline stages for execute and memory, right? Because if we want to have that cycle time, we should just have an execute plus memory stage and have to do less hazard handling as a result, rather than trying to do this forwarding and making our cycle time so long that we might as well have not, you know, that our cycle time is as if we just didn't have as many pipeline stages. So does that answer people's questions about when we can forward sort of reasoning? Can't. Okay, so then we had questions on data cache, and that was fall 2022 exams. To exam 8A. So this question. Okay, so in this question we had a loop here. Can I quickly copy this loop? Maybe. Yes, this loop. There. So we had this loop. Still wrong. There we go. So this loop here, and was asking about how many data cache misses will occur so data cache misses for A, B with three-way cache 16 sets, cache with 16 sets and 8 byte blocks, which I think is what's relevant to this question. Blocks and our array of integers plus array of 4 byte ints. Arrays of, and A and B are arrays of 4 byte ints. And we want to basically look at the innermost loop here. So in the innermost loop, we're accessing the same BJ over and over. So that's going to be kind of at most one miss per J for BJ. So one, at most one miss, and I guess it's, and we're advancing by BJs in order by, you know, sequentially, so we're going to expect one miss for BJ for this J loop here for every other iteration, because that's our block size fits 2. And blocks fit 2 elements. And for AI, we're accessing the same AI. Here we expect one miss for AI every other iteration. We would expect that, where we need to look at sort of our overall pattern here. So here we're accessing A of 0, A of 1. Think of our pattern is we have that we know what's happening for BJ. For A, we have we're accessing A of 0, A of 1 up to A of 15, then A of 0, A of 1 up to A of 15, and we're repeating this 1024 times, you know, for each BJ. And a way you can think of this is that, well, our cache, it has 16 sets and it's three ways. So we can actually store, you know, so we can store, we can store all of these in eight sets of the cache, sort of in one of the ways of eight sets of the cache. And we have plenty of room left over for all the Bs. So we don't need to worry about the Bs and As interfering. And that means we're going to kind of have, you know, one miss for every other A, I, when J equals 0. But when J equals 1, well, we have already loaded those AI, A0 through 15. They're still going to be there because our cache is big enough. It holds 16 sets. And we can, in fact, fit, you know, these 16 values from A in 8 sets. So it's not going to be a problem. And what we've done here is we've done cache blocking where, you know, we're fitting this block of A, this group of A's in our cache. And this one element of B, we could maybe do better by blocking in B or something, but maybe not. So there. And so if we count up the misses here, assuming I did this right, so we get sort of, we need to count the number of iterations of these loops to finish this process, because I've marked kind of how many misses we have. I can kind of consolidate that by saying that we're going to have sort of for each J loop, we're going to have 0.5 of a miss for B of J and 0.5 of a miss for, sorry, I guess 16 times 0.5 of a miss, because we have 16 A's we're going to work on and half of them are going to be misses for A of I, which is going to be a total of 8.5 misses. And we have 1024 divided by 16 times 8.5. 1024 iterations of the J loop. So we have 1024 divided by 16 times 8.5, which does it. Times 8.5, which is that actually the answer I get? No. I loop. Oh, right there. I wonder if my key is wrong. Because I swear I set that question up to, and maybe did I not update the key? Huh. Because I'm, yes, we should definitely have, so we're not, we're changing. Yeah, so that's what I get, which is not the key that's written on the quiz and in the exam we have posted, I think. Yeah, question? Question, why is the number of times the J loop runs 1024 divided by 16? Because that's how many times this, that's how many II's there are. Because it this runs 0, so this is 1024 divided by 16 because we have I, we run it with I equals 0, then I equals 16, I equals 32, and so on. And there's a 1024 divided by 16 of these. Does that answer your question? Questions, why is the number of times the J loop runs dependent on? Okay. So this is, yeah, this is how many times we run. So, right, I've written this wrong. How many iterations where the J loop is started? The J loop is started. It's not the number of iterations of the J loop, it's the number of times the J loop is started. Yes?
So each time you run the J loop, you get a total, I guess, of eight misses for the case by eight by part. But shouldn't you get a miss for every other
Yes, I see what I did wrong here. Okay, so we have, for each J loop, we have this, and for each iteration of the J loop, we have 0.5 of a miss for B of J. Yes, sorry, I was not counting carefully. I was wondering why I disagree with the key, and that's why. Okay, so, and this is get me, for every other iteration of this loop, miss when J equals 0. I labeled it right here, and then applied that wrong. So, this here, iterations where J equals 0. So there's that many iterations where J equals 0, and there's iterations of the J loop in total. Okay. Sorry, I did write the key correctly back last semester, and didn't forget to update it. And so we have 1024 divided by 16 iterations where J equals 0, which is what I indicated for A of I. So I have 1024 divided by 16 times 8 misses for the A of I's. And then I have 1024 divided by 16 times 1024 times 0.5 misses for the B of J's. Yeah, sorry, this is not looking carefully at my work. Yeah?
Can you explain one more time how you got the number of A misses?
Question, how I got the number of A misses? So I've realized that we could fit, that the pattern for A is we're going 0 through 15, 0 through 15, and then after we do that 1024 times, we're doing 16 through 31, 16 through 31, and so on. And I know I can fit 15 elements of A in this cache because I'm told it has 16 sets with three ways per set, and there's no way there's not enough stuff to evict that given how frequently we're accessing the A's. So there's no problem keeping that in the cache. So I just need to make sure I account for the misses to load it the first time. And the first time I load it is one time, for each of these loops here, each iteration where we have a new II. I'm going to load each of those I. Each I equals I plus 0, I plus 1, I plus 2, up to I plus 15. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just want confused why it's why you say it's one miss for every other AI.
Question, why is it one miss every other? That's because our cache blocks fit two elements. Okay. So even if I only want to load A of 0, I'm going to get A of 1 anyways. Other questions? Okay, so then on dirty bits. So with for writes to caches, we have caches. If we are caching a value, we have two options. We have kind of write through, which is that always update the next level, sort of. Or write back, defer the update until later. And sort of a hope is that, maybe we'll change it again, and we'll avoid, sending redundant sort of extra updates to the next level. Or maybe we'll never actually, need to access it other than with the cache. Through this cache. So there's an advantage there. But with write back, we need to actually do the update eventually so it doesn't get lost. Because if we don't do that, you're going to write a value and wait a while and then read back the value and it won't be there. That would be really bad. So, and So one strategy we could try is, you know, whenever we evict something, update the next level. But this would be really slow because we evict lots of things that haven't changed. So we do lots of extra writes. So instead, we store a dirty bit that tells us if something needs to be updated in the next level. So we set this when we modify a block in our cache without updating the next level. And that helps us remember later that we need to do that. And generally, when we evict the value is when we'll do that. Questions about dirty bits? Yeah.
So correct
that write through does not have a dirty bit? Yeah. So there's no reason to have one there because we'll never have a case where we haven't updated the next level. Okay, so aliasing. I guess time. So aliasing is when we have, so this is two names for the same value. And the names are typically like we might have A of X and B of Y, you know, most common. So most commonly, A of X and B of Y, and this means that the compiler can't do some optimizations that might be obvious. So like if we're doing A of X plus equals B of 0, so if we're doing, say, this, you know, you might like the compiler to put A of X in a register, but the compiler needs to handle if A of X is another name for B of 2, in which case this code should execute, you know, and we should get the same result as of that, right? And in that case, the compiler can't just keep A of X in a register to have that be implemented correctly. So this kind of scenario comes up with all sorts of optimizations we want to do, you know, and is going to be annoying for us. So questions on aliasing or things? Yeah, and I guess also other optimizations, e.g., you know, vectorization, cache blocking, etc., where this would be a concern. So system calls. Okay, so we learned that sort of the processor reserves some operations for the OS. Generally, things with shared resources. So this includes I/O devices and also sort of OS managed data for things shared between users. You know, e.g., I shouldn't be able to access your program's data on Portal and vice versa. But that's going to be stored on the same machine. That needs to be managed. But many legitimate things programs want to do with, you know, sort of these shared resources. Resources like print to the screen, stop another program, you know, list, you know, other things, and sort of, we have an interface to run the OS via its exception handlers called system calls that programs deliberately trigger when they want the OS to help them. And the handler for exceptions in general runs in kernel mode, so it has access to reserved operations and resources. So it can do it if the OS author has decided that I'm going to interpret this request as letting the program say print to the screen. If the OS didn't decide to do that, well, you can't do it. Questions about system calls? Yeah. So the question is, does the context entail a system call? So this is, it could be triggered by a system call, but they're also, different from exceptions not triggered by program deliberately. So, related to, but different. So example, OS might switch away from your program, even though your program didn't request it, not a system call, since you didn't ask for this to happen. Your program didn't attempt to ask for this behavior. It just happened. Right. Some other exception would trigger it. E.g., be triggered by timer or I.O. coming in that the OS got to handle despite whatever your program was doing. So in system call, it's a request from a program. Other things? Yeah?
Is this recorded if you want to access?
This is recorded, and I will post this text file. Will there still be office hours after today? Yes, probably less. We have asked the TAs to correct the calendar for the office hours they are actually holding. And hopefully that will happen, and maybe we'll try to remind them. And I will hold office hours of some sort tomorrow. So I think I'm out of time. So we'll have office hours. I'll answer questions on Piazza and the like and so on over the next